We're doing the book of Shmuel. We had learned how Shmuel had anointed David, the youngest son. David is a youngster. He's in his late 20s. He's still single. It's interesting, we think of David going out against Goliath as this little kid. It wasn't so little because he's going to be 30 when he's anointed, right? He's king for 40 years. He's 30 when he's anointed. If King Saul's reign lasted for 2.5 years, so then at this point, where we're in King Saul's final year, David has to be about 29. So let's say 28, 29. He's not a little boy going out against Goliath. He's not a seasoned warrior, but he's not a little boy. He's the youngest of seven. The Midrash says that Yishai, his father, lived to the age of 400, and his father lived to the age of 400. You have generation after generation that lived a very long life, and were extraordinarily pious. Now, Saul has a problem that God has left him, and he is having bouts of what the Navi calls Ruach Elohim Ra'ah. A Ruach Ra'ah, a bad spirit, a very potent bad spirit. Ruach Elohim, when we use the word Elohim, sometimes Elohim means God, sometimes Elohim means judge, and sometimes Elohim comes to denote a massive form of. So Ruach Elohim Ra'ah can either mean a God-sent bad spirit, or a very potent bad spirit. So here the commentaries tell us, this is what we call melancholia, like melancholy, what we call depression. So Shaul is having serious bouts of depression. It's understandable. Without God interfering, it could be understood. He's just been told he will lose the kingdom. He's the first king, and he is told that it will not continue. God's taken it from him. He's messed up. So it's as though a person gets a message from God on your mission in life, you've messed up. Now go live out the rest of your life. We can understand that that's not too pleasant. What?
Your services are no longer required.
Your services, right. Your services are no longer required. Now, we just have to maintain perspective. Shaul was extraordinarily pious. There's a reason he was chosen as our first king. And although he erred, and his errors cost him the kingship, King David erred pretty harshly as well. And that's an understatement. You know, King David had big errors on his plate, and yet he was able to hold on to the kingship. We still have to discuss what the difference between them is. According to one opinion in Talmud, it was a question of luck. You know, King David was born in the right time, King Saul was born in the wrong time, and so when King Saul messed up, it just ended.
But Shaul was a lot holier than King David.
Shaul was even greater than King David in many ways, and that's a phenomenal idea, but that's not what Shaul feels right now. Right now, Shaul was told, it's over, buddy. Now, we're going to see that God sweetens the pill, because as good as it could be, it's going to be, and that it's his son-in-law that takes the throne. Can't get better than that. If it has to leave the family, let it go to the son-in-law. That's the famous line the mobsters always say. Why do you always keep family in the business? That way when we rob from one another, it all stays in the family. So, okay, so, you know, it stays in the family. Yes?
Do we have to say Elohim regarding like a use of that word that's not God?
No. No, but here it's not so clear whether it's a God-sent bad spirit or it's a powerful, potent bad spirit. So his servants tell him, send us out, let us bring you someone who knows how to play the kinnor, which is ordinarily translated as?
Violin, lyre,
harp.
A harp. Modern Hebrew, it's a violin, maybe it's a harp. We don't really know what any of these instruments are. Okay, He says, okay, find me someone. So then, someone speaks up. And this is David's arch enemy. He is also Saul's arch enemy. Saul has an advisor named Doeg HaDomi. And in Tanakh, names are not always the real name the person had. Doeg, well, maybe his name was Doeg. Adomi, maybe he was Adomi. We know that David's real name was Elchanan. He's called David, Moshe's real name was Yekutiel. He's called Moshe. We have names in Tanakh that are here to teach us concepts.
Moshe was Tuvia.
Moshe was Tuvia. He had 10 names, right? It's a verse in Chronicles. It's not me. The verse in Chronicles tells us Moshe had 10 names.
I haven't gotten that.
You haven't gotten what yet?
Chronicles.
The Chronicles. Okay, you'll get there.
You get there. They weren't called this in their lifetime?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Like, that's like a, like Moshe was a nickname. That's what's used to record it in the Torah.
It seems that God called him Moshe. You see, when God calls him from the burning bush, he says, Moshe, Moshe. This deserves a separate class. This is a discussion which begins with Moshe, actually, where some commentaries say, Batya, Pharaoh's daughter, oh, her name wasn't Batya, right? The Tanakh calls her Batya, just by the way, parenthetically, right? Batya, daughter of God. She had an Egyptian name. That she was Bat Paro. Okay, so Batya pulls him out of the water, and what did she call him? So some of the commentaries say she called him Moneus, which is Egyptian for Moshe. And then other commentaries say, wait a second, you can't say that. The Torah is translating names, then all the drushos from the names fall. So this becomes a huge discussion, which begins with Moshe, actually.
What does Moshe mean?
Will draw out. He was Mashui, he was drawn out, but his name was Moshe, to draw. He will draw the people out of Egypt. Yeah. So, back to our Navi. So, this advisor of Saul, Doeg HaDomi, he's the one who kept egging Shaul on when we were conquering Amalek. He kept saying, maybe you shouldn't kill everyone. Maybe you should let the cattle stay alive. Maybe at least leave the king alive. Why kill him right away? Let's leave him alive a little bit, and you could always kill him. He's in captivity. He's the one that made Shaul lose his kingship. He's the one who actually gave Shaul that bad advice, who kept pushing Shaul in the wrong direction. And now he's the one who's going to mention, hey, I know there's this great lad who has everything you're missing. He doesn't spell it out, but that's what he's saying. He knows how to play an instrument beautifully. He is mighty. He is intelligent. He understands. Oh, he's a man worth respecting, and God is with him. He's saying all the things that King Saul feels like he's just lacking now, and his whole intent in this whole long verse describing David is to get Shaul to be jealous, to get Shaul to hate David, and he will be David's nemesis throughout until he dies.
Was he just an evil guy? But did he get a kick out of it?
Doeg HaAdomi was a top Talmud Chacham. Boom! Okay.
His first name's Doeg. So.
Abir HaRoim is called. The master of shepherds, master of leaders. Doeg HaAdomi.
Doeg is just worrying, right?
Right. Our sages say he was called Doeg because God in heaven was worried about him. He had such potential to go in both directions. Huge in Torah, but he had potential to go two ways.
And now, Doeg.
Doeg doesn't have a portion in the world to come, as we will see. He's one of the four people who don't have a portion in the world to come.
But when you said he's going to be David's archenemy, did you mean Doeg or Shaul?
Doeg is David's archenemy. So, Shaul sends messengers to Yishai, to Jesse, and asks him, please send me your kid, David, who's out with the sheep. So Yishai takes a donkey and loads it with as much bread as the donkey could carry. He takes a huge flask of wine. He takes a young goat. And he sends David this gift to the king, which is a nice way of showing, I honor you, the king, even more than you've asked for. Notice that Yishai is from the tribe of Yehuda. The tribe of Yehuda has room to think that they should be the leaders. But notice his faithfulness to Shaul. Yishai has sent his eldest three children to serve in Shaul's army, and Shaul meets David. He likes him. He appoints David his arms bearer. He's going to carry Shaul's arms, and he sends words to Yishai, I like your son David, let him stick around. And whenever Shaul would get upset, so David would take the kino, whatever instrument that is, and play, and then Shaul would calm down, and his spirit would return. The Philistines gather to war. They gather to a place named Socho, which is in the tribe of Judea. They camp between Socho and Azekah in a place called Ephes Damim. And Shaul gathers with the people of Israel, prepared for war. Now, David has gone home. He's traveling back and forth, taking care of the sheep and taking care of Shaul. And now there's this huge Philistine. His name is Goliath. And he's also pretty old. His mother is even older. He's this giant, over six meters tall, very tall fellow. And he has special armor as he goes out to war. He's wearing...
Literally for 2 meters.
No, see, someone means 3 meters.
3 meters, okay. Six amos, so that's, he was over 12 feet tall. Okay, six amos, an amos is 22 inches, almost 2 feet. So six amos is, I don't know my meters well, but six amos is about 11 feet. Okay, a little over 11 footer. That's pretty tall. So, what?
And where you are?
It's also the maximum the helmet can get.
Okay.
The gravity will break everything.
Okay. So, he's wearing a helmet of solid copper. He's wearing armor, like the knights wear, you know, what do you call it, where it has...
Chainmail.
What?
Chainmail.
Chainmail. Okay.
Chainmail.
Chainmail. Okay. Just the weight of his armor was 5,000 copper coins. He's wearing shin guards on his legs where you can't hit his legs. From his helmet coming down on the sides are posts that will protect him so you can't hit his neck. And from the front, he has a piece of metal that comes down and protects his nose. And that piece of metal goes all the way down to his feet. And he has a man named Uriah the Hittite carrying a shield before him. Uriah is a great warrior in his own right. We're still going to see that he's one of the greatest warriors that ever lived. And that's his arms bearer. That's the guy just carrying the shield in the front. And Goliath goes out between the Philistine camp and the Israeli camp. And every morning, when we're about to say Shema, he comes out and starts calling us. And he's there to distract us from saying Shema. When Yaakov Avinu describes our might against the enemy, he says, Kara shachav, ravat shachav karye, mi yekimenu. He's like a lion when he lays down. He's like a lion when he gets up. Who can shift him? That's the description of Israel. When we lay down, when we get up, we say Shema, and that gives us a tremendous amount of strength. So, Goliath purposely goes out just before the crack of dawn, when everyone's about to say Shema, distracts them. And he's blaspheming, and he says, look, I'm this great warrior of the Philistines. I don't have any position. I'm like a regular Philistine. I've killed your top Kohanim, the sons of the Kohen Gadol, Hophni and Pinchas. I captured your ark. I took out the two tablets and Saul ran up and grabbed them from me. I've done so much on behalf of the Philistines. And look at me, I'm just a regular soldier. You appoint Saul. What's he done for you? Why is he king? And if he's a real man, let him come out and fight me. What do we have to have this war for? One-on-one. I'll take him on. Whoever wins, the other one becomes servants. So give us a representative who can stand up to me. And for 40 days, he's doing this, walking out and cursing us. And shaming Saul, and everyone's trembling, and everyone's scared. And he says, look at you guys, you wimps. I've shamed all of you. And no one says anything. Now, Yishai sends David to his brothers, his three brothers who are serving in the army, and he tells them, bring food for them, bring stuff for their generals, and take from them their collateral. So the simple reading is that the brothers had some loans and he was paying up their loans to free their collateral. But our sages had a different interpretation. Our sages say that Yishai already taught his children that when a person goes to war, he has to be concerned to be focused on the war and not focused on the home. If you go to war and you're thinking about your wife and your kids, you can't be focused on the war. You have to be focused on the battle at hand. But a person is thinking, I don't want to become an MIA. What'll happen if one's wife is left in Aguna? If she doesn't know if he's alive or dead, she can never remarry. Our sages say that sorrow is so bad, it's almost as bad as getting killed. For a woman to be stuck in limbo where she has no husband and can't remarry, and she stands there pining for her husband to return, and yet he might be dead, and she's going to spend the rest of her life like that, that's called the plight of the aguna. The word aguna comes from the word ag. Ag means to encircle. This woman is encircled with halacha. She can't get out. She can't remarry. She can't have her husband back. She's stuck. So our sages said technically her sorrow is so bad that the sages wanted to permit her to remarry without her husband walking back through the door. But Chazal said, what can we do? The prohibition of adultery is yeharik val yavar. A person should rather get killed than commit adultery. And as such, our sages said their hands are tied. They can't permit her to remarry because out of concern for her plight, they would have wanted to go that far. But that they can't do. So in order to ensure that their brother's wives, David's brother's wives, would not remain agunot, Yishai sent him with contracts that he wrote up in which the brothers sign a get to their wives. And they tell their wives, if I don't walk back through the door by this and this date, you are hereby divorced today. And then they write a date, let's say in a year from now. You assume by then the war will be over, he can come back home, and if not, she's divorced. And then David will institute this in his wars, where anyone who goes out to battle has to leave this get behind. So halachically, the get is very powerful. The idea of not leaving a wife stranded is very powerful. Ideologically, the get represents a phenomenal concept. When you go out to war, you cut ties with the home. Now you're focused on taking care of the general good. You can't be focused on what's going on back at home. That's why the whole country was in uproars in the Second Lebanon War, where in the beginning of the war, the chief of staff was selling off his stocks. They said, how could you have soldiers on the front line and you're dealing with the stock market? So people said, what do you want? You know, he's human. It's not like he's on the job every split second. He has a minute where he can make a phone call to his stockbroker. And most of the public didn't buy that. Most of the public felt, and I think rightfully so, that your job as chief of staff, you have thousands of soldiers whose lives are in your hands. You have to be 100% focused there. You know, the chief rabbi of the army at the time spent almost the whole war sleeping out on the front lines with the soldiers. He would encourage the battalions before they went out. He'd give them speeches and pep talks. He was interviewed afterwards. He said he came back from the war and he said to his wife, we have to date again. We have to meet one another again. We have to reintroduce ourselves to one another because he had spent so many weeks and months on the front line without taking a break because he felt that responsibility to be with the soldiers. So this is the idea. Yishai tells David, give him the get, the divorce contract. Let them sign it and bring it back. That's what our sages had a tradition. That's what it means. Take their collateral. Take their responsibility back home. Yes?
What does this mean for somebody that's captured?
His wife is free to move on. Now she can say, if she has knowledge that he's been captured, she can say, I'll wait. Okay. I don't want to accept it. I can wait for it.
She has right to get.
But she has a right to move on.
She actually can marry his wife.
It depends on what date you put in there. Meaning, you have to decide, are you putting in a year and a year and a half? Like, yes?
Is the ketubah itself, or like how that they marry, can that be have a contract built into it where if the person goes missing, chas v'shalom or whatever, if I assert you, if the person's not seen or known to be alive after a year and a day or whatever, that the marriage is annulled?
I have to think about it. It wouldn't be the ksuba, it would be the kedushin. I don't know if that's possible.
Seems like if that's not possible, then you should all. The boat should be issued with a get, saying that this get activates in circumstances.
We don't want... one of the goals of the ksuba is to give a feeling of permanence. Meaning the idea of the ksuba was because men are too fickle and their capacity to divorce is great. And men, if men find it too easy to get divorced, then they'll find themselves divorced very quickly. And so Chazal instituted many clauses into the Ksuba to ensure that it would be very difficult and costly to get divorced. And this way people think it over many, many times. Men and women. Very often people get divorced, and in hindsight, it really didn't have to happen. I know of a case where there was a lot of money to be divided between the two, and the woman was pushing for a divorce. And when they came, so in the first meeting, the head of the court said to the woman, "I just want you to know, we're going to move forward with the proceedings, and when we're done, this is the amount you're going to get." And he told her a very dismal alimony, where she'd be able to live in a little apartment, but not in the lap of luxury she was accustomed to. The divorce papers were rescinded that week, and they're still happily married. You know, when she thought that she could walk off with half his wealth, then it was a good idea. When suddenly it became, and you know, she'd have a better life this way. So, and I'm saying the head of the court sensed that that's what was going on. That this was, you know, she just thought, like, why not? So the kids will live a life where they visit this parent and that parent, etc. And he felt like it was a mistake to move this way, so he presented it to her that way.
Husband, do you still want to be married?
Yeah. I don't know. People, many a couple have been at the rabbinate to get divorce papers only to build a beautiful marriage afterwards. It's one of the keys you have to know. You don't try this, you know, that's like saying, you know. But
one of your notes that you write in your life. Let's head to the rabbinate.
It's not part of the Jewish show.
Beautiful.
You shouldn't get there. You should know that it could always be rebuilt. If two people are willing to work, then you can rebuild. Yes.
So are we going to transition now to Jewish home?
I want to do five chapters. We barely did two. So let's move forward. Okay. So David leaves the sheep with a guard, and he comes into the camp, and he hears what's going on, and he hears people saying that the king has promised that whoever takes down this Philistine, the king will give him great wealth, he'll have the king's daughter's hand, and his family will become free of taxes. And David says, really? What did the king say? What did the king say? And he's trying to get people riled up, and he says, I don't get it. Who's this uncircumcised one? He's going to curse God's camps. So the nation says, well, this is what the king says. Now his big brother Eliav hears how David is talking, like, why not take the king up on this? And he tells him, what'd you come down here for? You're looking for action? Who'd you leave the sheep with? I know your bad heart. You just wanted to see action. That's what you came here for. And David said, what did I do? I just asked people what's going on. That's all. And he leaves his big brother. Now remember, he's 27. He's not a little boy. He moves on. And Shaul hears what's going on. And David tells Shaul, don't let anyone worry about him. Let me go and take him. And Shaul tells him, you're young. And he's been trained as a warrior from the time he was a little boy. And David tells him, look, God gave me a sign. I was watching the sheep. And a lion came with its cubs to attack the sheep. And something came over me, and I ran up to that lion, and I beat him up and his cubs, and they all ran away. And at the same time, a bear came with its cubs, and the bear managed to grab sheep from the flock. And I ran after the bear, and I beat him up, and I took the sheep out of its mouth, and I brought it back. And then the bear turned on me, and I grabbed it by the beard, smacked the bear, and killed him. So David says to him, now you'll ask me what came over me. I don't know, but it taught me something.
Are we supposed to take all this literally?
Chazal tell us, yes, that sometimes in life, there were a few individuals who were given signs that God was going to give them extra protection. Esther had a sign that she was meant to do what she did with Ahasuerus. David had a sign.
He was not that, normally this strong, or not that strong, but...
Like, well, the Navi says that after Shmuel anointed David, he suddenly became much more brave. Something unusual happened to him. We
brave,
find
okay,
that...
But pure strength. Was he normally a strong person?
You see, he was. Chazal say he was. Chazal say that David would take his sword and charge the enemy, and he wouldn't stop, he wouldn't let his hand rest until he had downed 800 men. After 800, he'd get tired. And he'd be so upset, he'd say, you know, God, you promised in the Torah that we'll be able to take down 1,000. And I'm only doing 800. He would go and keep hacking at the enemy, and he wouldn't let his arm rest until he'd finish 800.
Why was he not a warrior? Why was he like shepherding sheep?
So that's a good question. Our sages say that... Right. Right. So our sages say that David and Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the sages, the elders like Yosef, they wanted to be shepherds because shepherding is a job that gives you a lot of time to think and connect to your Creator. It's a lot of time to philosophize, to pray. And perhaps it's also a job which involves compassion, caring for the sheep, seeing to their needs.
Is that why Yosef told his brothers that they're shepherds? Like when the brothers came down to Egypt and then Yosef...
That's a different discussion. So David says, look, if God gave me this sign, I was always wondering why. Obviously it's meant so that now I shouldn't be scared to go out against him. So Shaul blesses David. He says, go and God should be with you. And then he takes his armor and gives it to David. And when David wears it, so it fits perfectly. And Shaul looks at him and he's a little bit shocked. And David right away takes it off and he says, I don't know how to deal with all this. I'll be just fine without it. I've never practiced with this. And so he takes off the armor and he says, this isn't the way I'm used to fighting. I don't have a training. Let's leave this off. Yes.
Wasn't Shaul a lot taller than David?
So that's what our sages say. It was a miracle that it suddenly fit David's size. So David takes his stick and he goes out and chooses 5 smooth stones from the stream. And he starts praying. He takes his shepherd's knapsack and he takes his slingshot. And he goes out and approaches the Philistine. The Philistine starts charging. And he has Uriah the Hittite standing before him carrying the shield. And the Philistine looks down at David. Here he sees a kid with red skin and good looking with locks. And he says to him, you think I'm a dog? You come to me with sticks? And he starts cursing David by his God. And the Philistine tells David, come over here. I want to feed your flesh to the birds of heaven and the domesticated animals in the field. So David says, that's interesting. Domesticated animals aren't out in the field. He should have said wild animals in the field. This guy's drunk. He's lost it. He's finished. Now, the Philistines, Goliath's spear, the verse says, was so thick it was like a beam that you used to wrap the... What do you call the strings when you weave the harp and the woof?
Lyre?
You have 2 beams that the lines of thread go through.
A loom.
The loom, right. Like a beam of a loom. So it was this huge, like, it's a huge spear. And Goliath is holding that in his hand. And he's approaching, and David tells him, you're approaching me with the sword, with the spear. You're approaching me with weapons, and I'm coming to you with the name of Hashem who controls all armies. He's the God who's on top of these camps that you've dared blaspheme. And today God will give you in my hand, I will knock you down, remove your head, and turn over the corpses of the Philistine camp to the birds of the heaven and the wild animals of the land. And everyone will know that there's a God in Israel. And then everyone watching will know that God doesn't save his people, not by sword, not by spear, because God controls all wars and he'll give us in your hands. And with that, the Philistine charges and David runs towards him. And David grabs his slingshot and takes a stone and throws it. And the stone is whizzing through the air, directly headed for the Philistine's
head.
For the Philistine's... For the Philistine's helmet. And it's not going to do a single thing. because the Philistine has a very solid helmet. And it's whizzing through the air. And the Medrash says there's an angel in heaven responsible for metal, for copper. There's an angel in heaven responsible for rocks. So the angels start talking. So the angel responsible for rocks says, "Hey, let me in." And the angel responsible for metal says, "Hey, what's it worth to you?" And he says, "I got a job to do. I got to knock down this Goliath off his feet." And he says, "I got a job to do. Protect this Goliath from your rock." So he says, "But let me in. It's going to be a Kiddush Hashem." So he says, "But you got to pay me for it. There's got to be, you know, you want something, so give me something." And so our tradition is that unnaturally the rock penetrated the copper and went into Goliath's head and killed him. And the deal that was made was that on that day they would stop using rocks for circumcision, and they shifted from this point onward in Jewish history to using metal knives for circumcision. That was the deal that, so to speak, in heaven was made. You let me through and we'll start using you. And as you look through the verses, you see that there's repeated allusions to the fact that the Philistines were uncircumcised throughout the story of David and Goliath. And David runs forward to cut off the Philistine's head, and he reaches for Goliath's sword, and it's locked into the sheath. And he turns around, and there's Uriah the Hittite, who is carrying Goliath's shield. And David says, "Tell me how you open the lock on the knife, on the sword." And Uriah says, "You know, I was just thinking that I want to convert to Judaism. But I'm wondering if I'll get a good Jewish girl. So if you promise me a good Jewish girl, I'll show you how to open the sheath."
Hello.
Tough call.
That was the best idea.
And David, so the verses seem to indicate he was dead. David says, "It's a deal. Now give me the sword." So a heavenly voice comes out and says, "You're making deals with my girls? He's getting your wife." And with that, it was declared in heaven that the girl who was meant for David, Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the granddaughter of Achitophel, the greatest advisor quite possibly that ever lived, would be handed over to Uriah. And so this little girl, Bathsheba, who's mamash a minor, I mean, she was 4 or 5 at the time, is given over after this war. Uriah actually converts. He becomes a top warrior. He's going to be one of the top 30 generals in King David's army. And Uriah marries this little girl who's very, very smart and very beautiful, named Bathsheba. And they will not live happily ever after, as we will see later on in Tanakh. Meanwhile, David unsheathes the sword, slices off Goliath's head, and takes it back to Jerusalem, which happens to be the first place where we actually find Jerusalem as a place of any importance. Then that needs a little bit of work. And the Jews charge the Philistines. And they keep knocking them down. Now remember the deal. The Philistines said, "One for one. And if you win, we're all your slaves." But now they're suddenly not up for the deal. And we'll have to pick up here. Bezat Shem. We should add one more point. But yes, Yaakov.
You take her age literally?
Yes, the Talmud tells us that the nature of people changed. That it used to be that people could get pregnant at a younger age. How old was Cleopatra when there was a world war fought over her? 14? 12? She was a little girl. And she was considered the world's beauty. So things changed. And we discussed this in the past. We proved it from the Torah that Yehuda's children were all minors when they got married and died. Er, Onan. They were little kids, 7 years old or something. And yet, you see, they were highly intelligent. So the Talmud already asked this question. Meaning the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin does the math that Achitophel had to be in his early 30s when he died. And he was already Bathsheba's grandfather. So then the Talmud starts doing the math. Okay, so how old was Achitofel when he got married? There you have the same calculation about Chur. Chur in this week's parsha, who was a little boy. Okay, you see it throughout Tanakh. If you start doing the math in Tanakh, you see that people got married very, very young. And the Talmud says that in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu through David HaMelech, the earlier part of Jewish history, girls were able to become pregnant at a younger age, and boys were able to impregnate at a younger age. The Talmud says that. Yeah?
A couple questions. Why is it important that that the Philistines are uncircumcised?
Okay, what's your next question?
My next question is, what is somebody's original thought to use a stone to circumcise as opposed to a blade?
Okay, next.
And my next question...
So far, we can try to deal with all these on Thursday night, but they're okay, yeah? Or on a one-on-one as we walk. What else?
And my last question is, what did he mean by a domesticated animal in the field?
So he didn't have clarity. In Hebrew, there are two terms for animal. There's behema and chaya. Behema means domesticated animal, usually, and chaya means a wild animal, usually. So if he meant the animals of the field, animals that run wild, he shouldn't have used the term behema. And the Navi purposely shows us that he called them behemata sadeh, as opposed to David, who called them chaya.
Okay.